Accession number 32717, reel 2.
So we had to fly in and wait our turn, work our way down in order to make the landing. There was a fellow in a B-24. Well, I don't know if it was you, Howard. He'd gone up with his turbo superchargers and was up there 24,000 feet, didn't want to come down, but he had a long way to work his way down. We stayed here a couple days, and then we took off without any putting any more fuel in those temporary tanks and flew up to Tunis. By this time, the campaign in Africa was over with, so that it was safe to fly over that area. We stayed overnight in Tunis, and then the next day we left for Cairo, Egypt. By this time, the engines had 50 hours on them, and the crew chief had to stay on the base and do the 50-hour tune-up on the engines. I would have been changing the plugs, but anyway, we had to stay at the base. The rest of us went into town and went out to the pyramids and saw the Sphinx, and I'll never forget, the youth there would, if they could, they would segregate one fellow from the group and they'd pick his pockets, and that happened to one of our men. And then they would tell us that we were big American suckers. Big American suckers. And I never forgot that. We left Israel then, I think it was 2 days later. And apparently it was Saudi Arabia that we could not fly over. We flew up in this direction and flew over Jerusalem at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And then we landed in Abadan in Iran at about 10 o'clock again the next day. The temperature was 120 degrees Fahrenheit when we landed. And we went over to the barracks, which was a cement block building, and then they had these swamp coolers to cool it in there, and it was a stinking mess. But that was the only place that we could go to sleep. Is this thing still working? Can you hear me now?
No.
No.
It's on.
Can you
hear me?
Can you hear me?
I hope this one's still working. Makes you get Charlie Boyle here. He's the old expert.
One of the fellows in our group of C-47s landed so hard at Abadan that his crew chief, who was standing in the companionway behind the pilot seat, broke his leg. The poor guy wound up in the hospital at this helpful. Oh, you have to wait a minute until I get the right overhead here. That's crazy. India, which is now in Pakistan.
Bring the mic up closer.
We were there a couple of days, And
where were you before? They couldn't hear you. Karachi was?
Karachi, India. That's where we landed here. We had come from Abadan, Iran, to Karachi, India. And it was, as I say, we were there for a couple of days. Our temporary navigator was relieved of his duties, and he would catch the next flight he could get back to the States, and then would make another trip. Okay. So thank you. You're on the cord. One thing that was curious in India at Karachi was that the natives all had kind of reddish stuff that was in their mouth, that were spitting out. And the only thing I could think of was this ad for Ipana, or for they had bleeding gums. Well, it wasn't that, it was betel nut they were chewing. From here we got orders to report to the 10th Combat Cargo Squadron. So we flew over here to Agra, where the Taj Mahal is located, and we spent the night there. I wasn't able to go in because of not feeling well, but we circled it, and the rest of the crew members went in and visited it, which was really something to see. This emperor had built this for his bride, as I understand it. Then from there, the next day, we flew across India over here to Sylhet, where the 10th Combat Cargo Squadron had been located, but they had just moved up to Dinjan. So we spent the night there, and the next day flew up here to Dinjan, which is our home base. This is the province of Assam, and that's where we flew, where I was located all the time that I was over there. When we arrived, of course, we reported to the CO, who was a captain Duke, and in our best aviation cadet manners, you know, sir, Lieutenant Severson reporting for duty. But, well, they welcomed us, and they were very smart, because even though we had flown this airplane, those of us who flew it in the left seat, and we had quite a few hundred hours, they put us with another pilot for the first 3 days to see what it was like flying over into Burma. Now, the situation in Burma was that the Japanese had captured most of Burma by this time. What I didn't know and didn't remember, we were kind of isolationists in the Middle West, that Japan had invaded China in about 1937 on the east shore, east coast of China, and they'd gone inland perhaps 100 miles. And they had completely blockaded China from getting any supplies by sea. Then they came around below Vietnam, came over here, and Rangoon is located right here. The American volunteer group under Claire Chennault were getting P-47s and were training, and then they were going over here to China to fight the Japanese. Well, when I arrived, the Japanese had gone all over Burma, and they'd come to a place called Imphal. And this is where the concept of the combat cargo was organized. The idea that you would supply ground troops, infantry, by air, all of their supplies, because they were fighting in a jungle. And it was a new concept, and they used C-47s to begin with. Later on, they used, I guess, C-46s. But in my time, it was C-47s. So bear in mind that all of Burma was cut off, and the Japanese encircled this town of Imphal, and they wanted to cut the railroad line from Calcutta up here to Lido that would go on over to Mishanoth to supply the Chinese. And so This was a totally new concept, that if we would fly supplies and drop them wherever they had the correct panels in the ground, and would drop them food, ammunition, and what have you.
Yeah.
Well, the first day, after we'd been there for 3 or 4 days, and we were going to go out on our own, my roommate, who was Bob Rohde, and his crew came across here from Dinjan, across the mountains, went to a point here called Hell's Gate, and then had a load that was going into Shimbiwang here. It was a fighter strip. Well, as I said before, we hadn't had much actual instrument flying, but we had instrument weather, and Bob was trying to let down and get underneath it, and it cleared just as he was in the treetops. And he hauled back on the wheel, and full power, and he managed to keep it flying, got back up in the air, and flew back from Shimbiwang here, back here to Dinjan. He took about a bushel basket of wood out of his right engine nacelle, and he had a big dent in the stabilizer on the right-hand side, and that's how close he came to getting it on his first mission in Burma. They get a lot of rainfall here. And a P-47, it crashed after takeoff, and they sent out a rescue party. They had to cut their way through the jungle. It took them a week to get to the guy. They saw that he was alive flying over, and it took them a week to get back. And that they got close to 500 inches of rainfall. Things really grew fast. We were based up here in the province of Assam, it's over here, and we flew over into Burma, and all of the flying that I did, with the exception of the two trips to Kunming over the hump, were made here in Burma. I flew a total of 223 missions. On this map, I have two maps up here that show our route, and I know you can't see them very well, but maybe you want to look at them afterwards if you're interested. As I was making this overhead, I couldn't spell China properly. You'll notice I just cross it out. Anyway, the Japanese had invaded China to the depth of about 100 miles, and they shut off all supplies coming into China. They came around here, and then they cut the Burma Road, which went from Rangoon up here to Mishanaw, and they were marching across to get to India and cut off the railroad that went from Calcutta up to Assam, so they would shut off the supplies completely to Chiang Kai-shek. There is my airplane, and I guess I'm looking out the window. Here's a picture of myself on the left and my co-pilot on the right while we were flying. And down below are my radio operator on the right and my second crew chief on the left, Lynn Dorsett from down in Texas. Thank you. This was taken on our day off. The four of us bunked together in a barracks that looked like this. We were very fortunate. This had been a British base. So we had a regular building with thatched roof and divided into rooms. And on the back side of it was a flush toilet and cold showers. This is my co-pilot, Andrew Bomber, myself, Bob Rohde, who was officer of the day, and his co-pilot, J.R. Andrews. These two are both deceased. I know.
Did you like to read my book?
Good, I had a word better reason.
Okay.
As I say, we were very, very fortunate to have the living quarters that we did when we were there. One day I had a trip into a place called Tin Coxican. It was a base cut out of the jungle in central Burma, north central Burma, and it was a P-47 fighter base. This is my roommate, high school acquaintance, Adolf Berg, that I wrote to Norga about. And here I am. I just made the trip in there. He was an armorer loading these P-47s with ammunition. I don't think you can see this very well. This is a couple of our Basha boys that would take our wool uniforms out on days when it wasn't raining and air them out. And here we are flying formation. I was probably taken over the Atlantic somewhere. Are there any more options?
Yeah.
How's that?
Attaboy girl.
Some of the trips that I had over into Burma were quite interesting. Going into this place called Tin Coxican, where Adolf Berg was located, it was a fighter strip cut out of the jungle. The trees were about 125 feet tall, and it was instrument weather. So you'd come over with the automatic direction finder, your radio compass, and locate the field and ask them to give you a long count. So you located yourself with the field, you knew what the magnetic bearing of the runway was, and you'd fly out at so many minutes, make a procedure turn over, come back, and check again when you're abreast of the control tower, come back around and make another letdown out of the clouds to go in there. My first time doing that, I missed it by just half of the span of the airplane, so I had to pull up in the soup and go around and do it over again. But it was a real pleasure to see Adolf. Another time I had a land drop load. It was probably about here, where we were dropping gasoline and supplies to a forward air raid warning station. It was up in the mountains, on a mountain peak, And they had radios, of course, and they needed everything brought flown into them. They had a very small target. And this was the first time that I'd ever dropped 55-gallon drums of gasoline. We got our complete load off and only hung one parachute in the trees. They were very happy. And so theirs was a kind of a boring life. So we took that C-47 and climbed it up to about 5,000 feet and then did a fighter pass over them. And they appreciated that, too. We're out there in the wilderness, nobody around. Another time I opened up a field, which was probably about in here in Burma, and it was during the dry season, and they had simply knocked the ridges, that's how they made these landing strips, knocked the ridges off the rice paddies. And J.R. Andrews was my co-pilot that day. We went in there, and the dirt was just like powder. So we landed and didn't roll very far. Had a light load, got unloaded, fired up the engines, and went down as far as we could to the end of the runway. It had almost full power on both engines, but a little more on the left, rolled it around, and everything to the firewall, and just staggered out of this dust. And J.R. Andrews, he thought I was crazy. I don't know what the alternative was, but we had to get out of there. Another time I landed on a sandbar in the Irrawaddy River, which is this is Mishanon, this is the river as it flows down through here. It was about in this area that I landed on a sandbar delivering a light load to natives and to CIC men, Counterintelligence Corps. They were fellows that worked behind the lines doing damage to the Japanese wherever they could, and were also spying. Then on December 10th, I guess it was, 1944, the orders came through to move two divisions of Chinese troops back to China because the Japanese were capturing the landscape over there very rapidly. So what we did, we would take off from Dinjan with a load, fly it to Mishanon, unload it, and then we flew to a small field over here about 20 minutes away, and here we would load up a load of Chinese. And this was quite an experience because we knew that whatever gasoline we had here, there was never any gas for us over here in China. So we had to make this trip, go to China and get back on the 800 gallons. Well, as these Chinese started entering the airplane, "Ding hao, ding hao." And of course, beforehand, we prepared our airplanes. We had litters to carry wounded people, and we had a lot of first aid kits. We took all of that was loose and could be stolen, took it up front with us, and loaded these people in. And this first load I had, I don't recall how many, but they come along with hand grenades on their belt, ding hao, or ding hao, you know, and with a great big iron kettle that they used to cook their food. We used it on the farm to cook slop for the hog, but it was a great big iron kettle. How much load do you have? How much weight do you have? You have no idea. So what do you think? You got it off, you cut it off, close the door, and hope that it'll fly. We flew over to Tianyi, which is just right close here to Kunming. This is Kunming, and this distance here is, I forget what it is, but total of it's about 750 miles, I believe. There's very rough mountains in here, terribly high mountains, and as you look on the charts over there, you can see them. We were on a latitude that was comparable to central Mexico, and we had prevailing westerly winds. So going over, we had a favorable wind. After we were unloaded, and then we had to get back here to Dinjan, I chose, because I'd known from my experience that the higher you go, the stronger the winds, I chose to fly over enemy territory at a lower elevation so I could get back here to Dinjan with the gas that we had. We lost an airplane on that first day. There were 88 airplanes that loaded Chinese and hauled them back to China. And one of them was flown by a fellow named Dan McGrew, Dangerous Dan McGrew, we called him. Never found him. We made two round trips, and we moved 25,000 troops, mules, and all of their other gear to help fight off the Japanese in China. And that was what they called the hump. These mountains, which you'll see on the map over here, would go, let me see, okay? We're looking at 12, 15, 14, 14. This is Kunming. Here's Mishinaw. We fly over, unload, pick up a load, go to Changi, and then come back. And I chose to fly down here where the mountains weren't so tall. And hopefully the winds weren't so strong. And we made two round trips successfully. On the first trip, I got a real surprise because we've been flying out of Dinchen, which was an elevation of about 300 feet above sea level. We go here to Changi, and it's over 6,000 feet. And I'm making power reductions as if I were home. Well, I soon found out that was no good. And I wound up with full climbing power to keep that airplane in the air to get it on the ground. I didn't do it a second time, but the air was thinner, and we had a heavy load. So anyway, we did that, and they were moved to these two divisions in about 3 or 4 days. Then we go back to dropping supplies. We were dropping to a place right here, which the Japanese held all of this territory, and the drop zone was in a Verano Valley, and these the mountains from this direction. So we would climb up, go around here and make 180 and come back down this valley and make your drop and go around and do it again as if you were shooting landings. Well, they had a novel way of delivering peanuts and things of that nature. They put it in a tight bag, big one, and then they had a loose bag around it. So when the bag hit the ground, the inner bag broke and the outer bag caught the material. Well, pretty soon, I don't know, a third or fourth passed, we heard a rat-tat-tat-tat, and I didn't know what the heck it was, and I looked back in the bag, and the kickers had just put their, kicked the food out, or whatever they were hauling, and one fellow there was blood all over the place. The co-pilot got out, went back to help him, and the crew, the radio operator, bless his heart, he got up in that astrodome, and he told me when they were coming. And I'm up front now, alone. And each time, they made 8 passes at us. But when he told me they were coming, I put that C-47 into a slip. I wasn't thinking. It just cracked her over in a heck of a big side slip. They would hit our tail and our wingtip 7 more times. But they never came up the center of the fuselage again. Now my co-pilot is in back. He's helping the other guys. The radio operator has been wounded, but he's staying up in the Astrodome. And about this time, then the fighters get there. Well, I knew that just a short distance away at Bamo was a field hospital run by Dr. Seagraves. So maybe you read about him. He's quite famous. And I wanted to get those men to medical attention. And I'm kind of excited, too, of course, for having had this happen. And I reduced the power, put down the gear on the C-47. If you let it drop by itself, you can lock it. And then I went to put down the flaps, and I looked over, no hydraulic pressure, none whatsoever. And I'm already committed to land. And on this short strip, on both sides at the far end, were airplanes, C-47s, unloading, probably 6 or 8 of them. Well, we got on the ground, and I couldn't stop it. So I just steered it between 2 big trees. It went up over a roadway by a dike, and tore off both wings of the airplane, ruined one of Uncle Sam's airplane. But we got everyone for medical attention.